Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 4th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Religion in Company Towns, Session 1 of Company Towns in the Pacific Northwest, presented by Linda Carlson, number CAL 2003-01. Let's listen in.
My name is Linda Carlson, and I am the author of Company Towns in the Pacific Northwest, which is a brand new book from University of Washington Press. The first 15 copies to be for sale are in the bookstore, were in the bookstore here today. And if you don't want to buy a book here, but you do think you might want one, there are some order forms which are up here, and you can order directly from the University of Washington Press. This book covers approximately 100 company-built or company-dominated communities in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. And the topic for today is how is religion addressed in those communities? For most of us, if we know anything about company towns, I think that we have a preconception that these were pretty rough and tumble towns. A lot of the people were hard drinkers, hard gamblers. Certainly was my assumption that a lot of the employees were illiterate. What I found when I started doing research was that this was not completely accurate. And I also found that these communities were served with some sort of religious service very early on. Starting in the 1800s, there were mission programs to logging and mining camps, some of which we're familiar with. One being, if you're from the Pacific Coast, and especially if you read the Lutheran regularly, you've read about the mission boats that still serve the coast. And those started very early on. And they served in the eastern part of the country, and they particularly served in the Great Lakes region before they got west. But we had logging camp mission programs, and that included missionaries who preached in cookhouses or spoke one-on-one, often with people who had been severely injured and may have been facing death. They had missionaries who organized Sunday schools and children's choirs and even performed an occasional wedding. These people were called sky pilots. And when I heard that first, I just assumed that was because they were on small planes and they were flying into communities. But in reality, that phrase was coined very early on in the 1800s by a man named Frank Higgins, who said that his ambition was to pilot men to the skies. So I guess the idea was to get guys to heaven, and that's where sky pilot came from. Many of these men were not initially welcomed when they went into the communities that they served. There was a man named George C.F. Pringle who spent 9 years as a sky pilot serving the tidewater logging camps of the Vancouver Island coast. And he wrote a book about this and said, I never went hungry or lacked a place to sleep when I was back in the camps, but they seemed to have little use for a preacher. I was almost always treated with a reasonable courtesy, never the slightest sight of horseplay, but in camp after camp, when I set up to do a presentation, nobody came. So, and there were similar comments from people who came along later. There was a man named George Redden who served originally in the Port Orchard, Bremerton area, and he had somewhat of a regular position that he was an ordained minister through the Presbyterian Church. And then he was an evangelist in the Concrete area, which, as some of you may know, is due west up here in western Washington. And finally, he ended his career serving more than 20 years in Bend, Oregon. And he served a 22,000 square mile area. He was what we would might call a circuit rider. He had dozens of logging camps that he served on an 8-week schedule. And in the beginning, he went there with no car. And the expectation was, he went there in the early 30s, I believe. The expectation was that he would ride the logging railroads, but he was asked to sign a waiver so that if he was killed on the logging railroad, his family wouldn't get any compensation. And he had a wife and two children, I believe, and he's written this up. His daughter sent me some things that he wrote, and he said he wasn't willing to do that. And so he hitchhiked between the logging camps. But he said, that basically nobody was interested in his sermons. The only reason that Walkers came out to hear him was that he had trained as an opera singer, and he could really do a hymn sing. So he said when he started to sing, people would turn up, but that was primarily the reason. And he overlapped in service with a man who served Ryderwood, which was a long bell timber camp in southwestern Washington. They cut the logs there, and they were shipped into Longview, Washington, to be cut. And this was a very large community, probably had 2,000 people. And so the man who served there, Ted Goodwin, and he was there during the Depression, that was his only responsibility. He didn't have to do like George Redden and go from community to community. But he made a point of going out in the woods and working with the loggers. That was the way he reached most of the loggers. And he said when he first arrived and went out, they made it clear they did not like ministers and they did not like sky pilots. And why was he there? But he said eventually they came around, and he always had more lunch invitations than he could fill than the days that he was out with them. And of course, he was there when their children died, or he was there when someone was severely injured. So that was part of his service. But most of the men who were out in early years talked about the obstacles that they had to overcome in developing credibility with this audience. Most
question.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like it was this mostly the men, but if there's these areas where children were dying, then obviously there were women there.
Right. Ryderwood was a family camp. And some of the camps that George Redden served were family camps, and some of them were what were called stag camps, where they were bachelor only. But even a stag camp, just like Holden was built, the idea in Holden originally was that you'd have this circle of management housing, and you'd have families here, but then the rest of it would be men in the bunk houses. So the assumption here was that there'd be about 50 people in family housing, and the balance of it would be single men or men living without their families. And that was very typical in a lot of logging camps. A lot of the communities had, say, 12 houses for the managerial or professional staff, and then the rest were men in bunk houses. But Ryderhood was unusual. Ryderhood was probably the largest timber camp in this area. They have 2,000 people. They had 12 years of school. They had an award-winning high school basketball. Yeah.
So what was the support level there for the minister, especially from the families? Was it much higher?
Ted Goodwin's comment was that his salary was paid by a lot of men he never met, but he had hundreds of kids in his Sunday school. As far as facilities, Ryderwood had a church. A few other communities had churches. Those of you who've been to Roche Harbor on San Juan Island have seen the church standing up there on the hillside. That was built by the McMillan family, which owned the lime mining company there. There were two company-built churches in Potlatch, Idaho, one for the Protestants, one for the Catholics. And in Richland, when the government took over Richland for World War II defense work, they built or moved in two chapels, one for the Catholics, one for the Protestants. But there were very few of these actual company-built, company-funded churches. There were communities where the company supported the construction of a church, but didn't outright finance everything. In DuPont, which was a gunpowder company, a gunpowder town built just south of Tacoma, it was built on the site of a Hudson's Bay community, and they turned over a Hudson's Bay building to the community church congregation to use for starters. And then eventually they provided a design and they provided some money, and the volunteers built the church. And a company house was provided as the manse. In Brookings, Oregon, the company manager's wife funded most of the construction of the church. And in some cases, the lumber was provided either free or was provided at a discount from the sawmill if it was a timber town, which most of these were. In Britannia Beach, which is a town of interest to some people here because it was the first town developed by the Howe Sound Mining Company. It was a copper mining town, very much like this one, built on Howe Sound in British Columbia. If you've been to Whistler and you've driven the Coast Highway, you've driven past Britannia Beach. There, the volunteers built in the early 50s a church with a wall down the center. So the Catholics went in one door and had their service, and the Protestants went in the other door and had their service. So I don't know what happened if the organ or the piano were too bad, but that's how it was handled there. In many, many cases, however, the ministers preached in a cookhouse, in a school, in a recreation hall, as they did here, or in homes. For example, at Roche Harbor, that beautiful little church up on the hill served also as a school in the early years. In a town called Kinzu in central Oregon, they had a recreation hall, much as was here, and they had the chairs on, they were like theater seating, and they were on 2x4s, so they slid them in for church services and movies, and they slid them out for roller skating on Friday nights. In Klickitat, Washington, where the founding, not the founding family, but the owning family for many, many years was Missouri Synod Lutheran, that was obviously the denomination of the church. But there was a Mormon congregation that met in someone's home for years. And that was very, very typical for Catholic congregations. Very seldom was there a Catholic church built until people, there was a large enough group and there was enough money gathered. But in many cases, the Catholic churches were not constructed by the company, and so those people often met in a home until they could get together enough funding for a church. And that was really true in Gilchrist, Oregon, which is a town in central Oregon that is was privately owned until the very early 90s.
Did they have priests, or did they do it by lay?
That's my next point. Almost never was there a full-time minister. Some of them, like at Port Gamble, the minister was a doctor and he lived full-time in the community, the first one, and he served the community both as doctor and as minister. But very, so I guess he could pray for you if he didn't have anything to say. And they had a church starting in 1879, so there was probably a lot of praying to go along with the doctor. Many of these ministers served several parishes. For example, in Gilchrist, the Catholic priest came from Bend. At DuPont, the original supply was from Whitworth College, which was at that time located in the Sumner area. And they sent a minister to DuPont. And then when Whitworth moved to Spokane, they sent the ministers to what is now Cooley Dam, and was at that time Engineers Town and Mason City when Grand Cooley Dam was being constructed. And that's quite a trip when you think about it. In the 30s, somebody was going out from Spokane on what was probably a two-lane highway all the way to Cooley Dam. DuPont was supplied for a time with a minister who came up from Olympia, and I'm assuming he came up on the train, and he had a portable folding organ he brought with him. Here, the ministers came up from either Wenatchee or Chelan. There was both a Catholic priest and an Episcopal priest who came up, and they usually came up during the week because, of course, they had to serve their own parishes during on weekends. In some towns, there's really quite a story on how they got in. In the coal mining community outside Tacoma, there was a community where the minister would get on the train in Tacoma, take the train out as far as he could, and then walk 3 miles to the congregation he was serving, and if he was really lucky, he got on one of those hand pump speeders to get back the 3 miles so he could catch a train back into Tacoma. And if he didn't make it, he had to walk. So there was a lot of that. And there were a lot of cases where the Catholics walked to the next town. I've found many stories where they walked 3 miles over railway trestles. And if you think about the railway trestles, they have spaces in between. And so these were people walking with small children to church. My family is here and they know that I'm afraid of heights, so imagine I probably wouldn't have been going to church that way. Yes, well done. In some cases, the communities were served by ministers who just, whenever they felt the calling, walked up. For example, in Northwest Washington, there was a town called Blanchard, and there were several logging camps outside Blanchard. And whenever the minister felt that it was time to do a hymn sing and an evening fellowship in those camps, he just walked up to them. This would have been probably about the time of the First World War. And maybe stayed the night and then walked back the next day. So that's how all the communities were served. In many cases, there were times where the pulpits were empty, or there was, even if there wasn't an official pulpit, there simply was no service. And then the townspeople were running programs. For example, in this community, the mothers ran the Sunday school program. And there were times when the denominations changed. For example, in Port Gamble, when they opened the church in 1879, the founding families were from Maine, and so it was a congregational church in the beginning. But then, when World War I came, they couldn't get someone from that denomination, and they brought in a Baptist. And then several years later, they brought in an Episcopal priest. But there were periods, for example, during the 1920s when they had no one, and the only services that were conducted were the Sunday schools that the mothers conducted. So, almost always the denomination was Protestant, either non-denominational or some particular Protestant denomination. The only company town church that I ran into that was Catholic from the beginning was, well, not in the beginning, but it was Roche Harbor, and that was when Reuben Tarte bought the Roche Harbor Lime Company from the founding McMillan family. He converted the chapel to a Catholic chapel. He had it reconsecrated from being a Methodist church to being Catholic. And that is the only situation that I have found where it was predominantly Catholic in the community.
Why is that so, do you think?
Because most of the company owners were Protestant. Most of the company owners were Northern European or longtime Americans. And you, as you know, probably there was quite a distrust of Catholics for a long time. And they just didn't have Catholic churches.
Were the workers predominantly Southern European or Italian or something like that? Were they mostly predominantly Catholic, or would they have been predominantly Northern European Protestant?
It depends on where they were, but by and large, they were Northern European. There are some exceptions to that, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But especially in Washington State, there was a census done early in the 1900s that documented not only where you were born, but where your parents were born. And there were counties where 25% of the people came from Norway, Sweden, or Denmark. Mm-hmm. You can imagine those were the ones that were working in the woods. So heavy, heavy Northern European. And some communities, some companies only recruited among those ethnic groups. Potlatch, Idaho is an example of that, where when they started building Potlatch around the turn of the century, the employment agencies were asked to send people of Scandinavian descent. So, okay, though I had some surprises when I was doing this research. One of the things I found was that although there was church in many communities, it was the church, not the religion, that was important to people. What became important was what the church caused to happen. If they had services, they had Sunday school, they had youth groups, they had Bible study, they had an altar guild. But perhaps as important, the churches sponsored the charities and the civic activities in the communities. They sponsored things like the Americanization courses. For example, in Potlatch, Idaho, a huge percentage of the original employees were not native-born Americans. And so they sponsored the courses that helped those people meet the needs for naturalization. They sponsored the local libraries. The two best examples of that are in Potlatch, Idaho, where the library actually started out of the church basement. And the idea was that that provided a socially acceptable form of leisure activity for the single men. And I will tell you, there were no taverns in Potlatch because the company didn't permit it. But that gave them something to do. And in McCleary, Washington, which is down by Elma, and was run by a man who was actually known to cater to the needs of single men. I mean, he was well known to bail out his favorite employees when they had too much Mountain Dew on the weekends. But his wife was involved with having the church established, having the Ladies' Aid established, and having the first library funded. And the churches often did the welfare programs. They helped out the families in need, and they often ran the holiday food basket and the Christmas gift program for disadvantaged families, particularly during the Depression. These churches were the ones that sponsored the military aid and social programs during World War I. DuPont is probably one of the best examples of that, because if you've been to DuPont, you know that it's right across the freeway from what was then Camp Lewis and is today Fort Lewis. And they started, right with World War I, having programs for the soldiers. And they continued for years. As long as there was a town, a community that was company affiliated at DuPont, they were still going to Fort Lewis and making candy for the soldiers. And then there was a group of women who went and sewed the patches on the soldiers' uniforms when they were promoted. So there was a long time relationship there. And the churches were responsible for many of the purely social activities in the communities, especially those that worked as fundraisers. They did carnivals, they did bake sales, they did rummage sales, they did talent shows, they did fashion shows, and of course they did silver teas. Obviously, many of these fundraisers were designed to pay the minister's salary or to do things like in DuPont, they ran fundraisers to pay the fuel bill for the church. And many of the first clubs in towns were church affiliated. They grew out of things like Altar Guild. But another surprise comes back to something that you mentioned, and that is that the churches actually reinforce the stratification of society. And they reinforce the segregation in the community. So much social life was developed around the church, and the churches tended to be tied to certain ethnic groups. So, for example, in Potlatch, Idaho, the Lutherans actually set up their own congregation as soon as they could, and there were people who lived in Potlatch who never knew a Lutheran because they weren't Lutheran. The Lutherans did not socialize with the non-Lutherans. And the other thing, and then of course the Catholics. The Catholics tended to be from Southern Europe, and they tended to be people who were in more menial jobs. And so you had stratification on the job, and then you had stratification in the community, because people who were in the lowest level jobs were not associating with people who were higher up. One good example of that is in Concrete, which was not a company-owned town, but it's company-dominated. And it had a large population of Italians who were brought in to sew the sacks of concrete because it was a job that nobody else wanted. And very often the Italians in a community worked on the railroad section gangs, and these were not people that people were going to associate. The railroad employees were a separate clique in a community anyway. So, but you had the stratification that was reinforced by the church. And the other way it was reinforced is it was an excellent way of dividing married from single, because the churches were established to do exactly what they wanted here, to create a stable community of families. And the churches did that, and they didn't do as good a job of serving the single men. You know, they just simply were not attracted to the church programs and the way the families were. Something else that surprised me was the importance of these towns, these company-dominated communities, especially logging communities, as a mission field. You know, I grew up thinking of mission fields as far away. We always think of the underdeveloped countries as the places where we sent missionaries. But it was very interesting to find out that as early as the 1880s, some of the major denominations were establishing mission programs, national mission programs, to serve logging and mining communities. There was a man named Reuben Nevis who came to the Presbyterian Synod in Western Washington, and he established about 30 mission communities in the period between 1883 and 1894. Not all of these were company-owned, but several of them were. In 1934, the Presbyterians in the same area had a total budget of less than $25,000, but out of that, they dedicated $2,780 to logging camp missionaries and $780 to mining camp missionaries, which is pretty impressive, I think. That's a fairly high percentage. So you had the Sky Pilots being funded by mission boards. You had the mission boats that we're all familiar with. You had a program called Church by Mail, which was essentially Church by Correspondence course that the Archdiocese of Olympia, the Episcopalians in Western Washington, set up. And what was really interesting about this is it was set up not in the early part of the century. It was set up right after World War II. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that was because they became convinced that there were a lot of people who were really isolated from church services. But I went through the archives at the Archdiocese of Olympia, and here's the quote when they were establishing the program from the bishop. "We want to stand back of these lonely fathers and mothers who are trying to keep up with their church." But they spent almost $1,500 in the first year when they established this program. They ran it for at least 25 years. By 1954, they were doing 25 mailings a year and circulating almost 600 books. They had a library that was not only church-related materials, and then they had a weekly devotional packet. So you could do family devotions or you could do Sunday school, and a lot of very tiny communities use these devotional packets to conduct what we would call Sunday school. And then, of course, they had the ministers who came from other parishes, like here. You know, ministers saw that as part of their job to come up here and serve Holden. And there's some interesting comments about their needs. One of the things I found when I was digging through my notes is in 1942, this is the Presbyterian Church, they were struggling because of tire and gasoline rationing. This was making it difficult for them to serve, obviously, all these miles. And they said, "We're having difficulty. While new needs have arisen, there are housing shortages that are contributing to morale problems, and there's an influx of war workers that are contributing to morality problems." So they felt there was an increased need for serving communities. And of course, they're thinking particularly of the instant communities that were put together because of World War II, but they were having difficulty serving them because they couldn't get the gas or the tires. Another thing that surprised me was what I would call the homogenization of the Protestant faith. In Potlatch, when a syndicate of warehouse or affiliate people built that town in 1906, they declared there would be two churches. There would be a Protestant church and there would be a Catholic church. The Protestant church was intended to serve a couple of dozen different Protestant faiths. It was called Union Church, and their assumption was everybody was going to come to the same non-denominational service. And that was it, period. That's what the company edict was. And it didn't last too long for the Lutherans. They were the only group that seceded early on and were able to negotiate a discount on lumber from the company sawmill so they could build their own church. But it was built on company land. It was the only privately owned structure in that town for years, but it was on company land. And the other thing, probably more remarkable, was in Richland. Does anybody know about United Protestant Congregations? Richland, as you may know, was a community that was set up by the government when they were beginning work on the atomic bomb. And the contractor, which was originally DuPont, and the government worked with the Washington State Council of Churches to set up what they called United Protestant Congregations. They had congregations sponsor Protestant churches. And originally they started with one Catholic church and one Protestant church, but the community grew so fast that in the end they had several Protestant churches. And they required that it be a non-liturgical church that sponsored the congregation. And whoever sponsored the congregation might not be the order of service that you used. And you couldn't use a fixed order of service. For example, we couldn't have gone into one of those churches and used the Lutheran liturgy or the Episcopal liturgy. So it was this very general service. But what I thought was very interesting was how they funded it. These churches were funded through national mission boards. For example, the Presbyterian Church contributed to it. And so all of the offerings taken on Sunday went to national mission boards, and they went in the percentage that the members of the congregation had declared themselves to be. So if all of us became a United Protestant congregation, and you said, well, we were originally Methodists, and it turned out that in this room, 20% of the people were Methodists, then 20% of the offerings would go to the Methodist National Mission Board. And if 30% of the people had said they were Lutheran, then 30% of the contributions would go to the Lutheran National Mission Board. So that was how the churches were funded. And there was apparently an occasional special offering that went for the basic costs of maintaining the church. But I believe the ministers were paid through these national mission boards. So I thought that was just fascinating. But it was also an example of how Richland operated in those years when everything was by government edict. No buildings had names. Everything was a number. The hotel was called Transient Quarters or something like that. The dorms had no names, and they had lots of single workers, so they had dorms. Everything was a number. So it's really government controlled and the ultimate. Now, how were the ministers paid? Well, obviously, some of them were paid through these rather unusual methods. Some of them were paid through payroll contributions, and Riderwood was an example of this. When a logger went to work in Riderwood, he was asked if he wanted to contribute to the church, and he could sign up to have 25 cents, 50 cents, a dollar subtracted from his paycheck each time and sent to the church. And a similar system operated in McCleary, where, as you'll remember, Henry McCleary was I don't know if he was hard drinking, but many of his employees were hard drinking. And McCleary was known to be a wide open town as far as bootlegging and prostitution. But even so, Henry McCleary had a payroll deduction line for his employees, so you could commit to supporting the minister that way. And Ted Goodwin in Riderwood during the Depression said that lots of those contributions were made by men who never crossed the threshold into church. But he did have, as I said, hundreds of kids in his Sunday school. So that was a very similar policy to what, if you went on Linda Jensen's hike today, she talked about the payroll deductions that were done at the time of bereavement. If when someone died, you could sign up to contribute to the bereaved family. And so that was similar here, and then in Roslyn, we had a similar situation. It's not how they funded the churches, but they had other things that went beyond the company store and March of Dimes and other things that we think of as our typical payroll deductions. What I found was a surprise was that there were two church services that you almost never saw in company towns, and they were weddings and funerals. You had no weddings because, if I can find George Pringle, yes. George Pringle's comment was, girls were very scarce. And obviously, if a logger or a miner went out to get married, he got married in his fiancée's hometown. But George Pringle did conduct a wedding on his boat, which was called the Sky Pilot. There was a woman who'd come in to visit her aunt at a Brooks Scanlon logging camp, and she met a high rigger, and they wanted to get married, and this was in the early 20s. And he was getting ready to marry them, and everyone on the boat got seasick.
Oh, no.
So they have problems that maybe some contemporary ministers don't have. And the reason you didn't have funerals was because you usually didn't have an undertaker, and you didn't have a cemetery. So in this town, if somebody died in the warehouse, they had coffins. And that's how you went out. And your family went out, too. And when we talk about the close sense of community here, I was very surprised to find out that if you had a death in your family in Holden, you didn't have any friends at the funeral until I talked to Linda Jensen and some other people, and then started looking at the boat schedule and thinking it through to go out to be at someone's funeral, you would have had to take several days off of work. You would have had to take the boat out. You would have had to overnight in Chelan, if that's where it was. And many people had funerals conducted in the hometowns where the people had come from. So there were very few funerals and very few weddings in company towns. In this town, there was one wedding in the mining years. And it was done when there was a minister working part-time, and the wedding was conducted in someone's home. So that's what I have prepared. And if you have questions about religion that I can answer, I'll be happy to.
Was it common in other towns like Holden to have the policy they had here where there couldn't be a church because they were afraid it would cause division within the community?
I think one of the reasons there wasn't a church here was it was Forest Service land. And that's one of the reasons to my knowledge, there is no cemetery on any Forest Service land. But I think, because the same company had churches, built churches up at Britannia Beach, and they were continuing to build them in the 50s. So I think it was probably more a matter of, it was Forest Service land, and this is all leased land except for the mining paths. So I think that was probably more of the issue, and what they told the people might have been, we don't want you to fight, but I think it was really the fact that it was Forest Service land. There are a lot of things that were controlled here because of the Forest Service.
You mentioned company-dominated towns as opposed to company-owned towns. Concrete, I think, was your example. What was the company that dominated Concrete?
The Superior Cement Company.
That makes sense.
And the mercantile was called the Superior Mercantile.
So how did it dominate? What is sort of the level of, you know what I mean, the corporate... dominance to rise to that level?
A concrete was not built by the company. I think concrete probably existed before the company came in, but a company came in when it became obvious that this was a great place to quarry cement. And they built some housing. They had the company store. They supported the school extensively. One of the things they supported were the Americanization classes, the adult ed. I think they built the rec hall. So there was a lot of company support, but it was not a company-built situation, and not every job in the town was dependent on the company. And that was one of the things that I looked at. You know, here, when you came into Holden, especially in the beginning, every job, short of the postmaster and the school district, every job was dependent on the company. And that was one of the things I used when I looked at communities. Now, Wilkeson, which is a town you're probably familiar with, Wilkeson is in Pierce County, and this was a town where the railroad came in and built a coal mine, but most of those coal mining towns were built on land that was given to the railroads as part of their land grants to get them to move west. And the land grant only extended part of the way into the community. And the other part of the community had been, I'm missing the word, homesteaded prior to that. And so you had half of the downtown was company owned and half of the downtown was privately owned because the people who homesteaded then sold. And Wilkeson had other industry besides the coal mining. So that's an example where there was mixed ownership. But there was a lot of company ownership there. I grew up near Eatonville, which was not built by a company, but early on it was dominated by a lumber company, and they owned one of the general stores. They owned housing. They were a major taxpayer, and they threw their weight around. A company owner was the mayor and a school board director at the same time. So it was heavily dominated for a certain period of time by a company.
Did the kids at Holden have 1 through 12 or just 1 through 8?
1 through 8, and there was a kindergarten for a while taught by someone, and I think it might have been taught in the basement of the school building where they didn't need that for classes. They had, to give you an idea of how large a family population there was here, at one of the Christmas parties in the 50s, they had 211 children under the age of 14 and younger. Now, those were not all Holden kids, because the kids from Lucerne and the kids from Meadow Creek, which is a resort straight across the lake, were included in the holiday parties. But most of the kids who lived at Lucerne went to school up here. There was only a school at Lucerne for a while.
So they'd have to bus them up or something?
Mm-hmm. I think they came up on the bus. The company ran a bus from Lucerne because so many people commuted from Lucerne. That was a community of about 50 people for quite a while.
How many communities in the Northwest were you able to identify that met your qualification of a company-owned or company-dominated community?
Well, I probably looked at about 300 communities, and here were my criteria. It had to be more than a temporary camp, because there were a lot of camps that came and went. And there were, at one point, about 1,500 timber camps alone, and I think that was just in Washington. So it had to be fairly long-lasting, and it had to have some family life. And it had to be either company-built or company-dominated. And I, in the Gazetteer, there are 105 communities. So some were shorter-lived. Oh, and I only covered those communities which existed well into the 1900s. So there were communities like Seebeck, which was a company town, but it was prior to 1900.
I just wondered about, you mentioned about the church community charities, and then I was just thinking in a company town, did most everyone have a job? Was there a lot of need for charity, or do you have a sense of that?
Where you really saw it was during the Depression. Well, there were two things that happened. One is virtually nobody in a company town worked 52 weeks a year. This was probably an unusual example of where you did. But there, in a timber town, they almost always had a shutdown due to fire danger in the summer and due to snow in the winter. And so virtually nobody got 52 weeks of work. And in a mining town, especially coal mining, they often did not get 52 weeks of work. So that is what created some problems. And then during the Depression, the towns shut down. Those of you who have been to the museum probably know that this town was actually established in the early 30s. And that's when Honeymoon Heights was built originally. There was a cluster of structures up there, and they could accommodate 105 men in the early 30s. But they couldn't get the ore out economically, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that they could not at that time get trucks to run it down. And so they shut down, and then it started up again in the later 30s. But most of the timber communities shut down. There were very, very few timber communities that made it through the Depression without at least some sort of a stoppage. And some were shut down for a fair amount of time.
Could you still live there if the operations were going?
In most cases, there were people who chose to stay on. Kinzu, Oregon, was a town that had a one-week shutdown. I think that was the shortest shutdown I saw. But a town called Balsettes, which is outside Dallas, they shut down for several years, and they had a little one-car train that ran up from Dallas with the groceries, and the school continued, but I think they had about 30 people who stayed on, was all, and sometimes the family stayed and the men left for whatever odd jobs they could find, and some of the men got hired as fire wardens. The town where there was a lot of charity work done, most notably, is Culiacán. Because what happened when they started work, Grand Culiacán was a WPA-type project, and it attracted people from across the country. And these people showed up, and they were living in packing crates or in their cars. And so there was a real need to serve those people. And the other thing was the workload was like this. And so people got hired, but then they got laid off. So that's part of where the charity. It was very interesting. I sat and read the Mason City Columbian, which was the, I think it was a weekly paper that they put out. And I got it on an interlibrary loan from the Washington State Historical Society. And they ran card parties to finance their holiday baskets. And they had benefit movies. If you came and you brought a canned good or a glass of jam, you know, jelly jar full of probably homemade jam, you got in the movie for free. And then they had groups of people who got together and repaired toys and repaired clothes that could be redistributed to the needy. So what else can I tell you?
So this had a school district, Holden did?
Holden, the first year Holden operated, it was a company school, and then they affiliated with the Chelan County. It became a Chelan County school district.
So from that point forward, it was just paid for by general taxes, not my income.
But what was interesting here is the mine did not want to pay to house teachers. And so they made sure that for years the teachers were all wives of employees. And there was some question about, and I've never asked Florence Field, who was the longtime principal, whether she got hired before her husband got hired. He was the crane operator down at Lucerne. But that was pretty much the policy, is that the teachers were employees. And then after the war, there was a little more flexibility because they had more trouble bringing people in.
How long did it take you to do all this research?
Forever. We came here 6 years ago, so 98. And I have not started on then. But I grew up in Pierce County in the midst of a lot of company-owned or company-dominated towns, so I was familiar with the concept. And then in 1979, I spent the summer working for a forest products company in San Francisco, which had owned communities similar to this, probably a little smaller. I think most of them had about 400 people, and they were accessible only by company railroad. And one of the things I did was outline a company history, and I was just fascinated by the idea that the guys took their one day off and they built a rec hall, or they all got on the railroad and they went to the next logging camp run by the same company to have a baseball game. And it was interesting to me, you read in these company newsletters about how Mr. and Mrs. Jones went out on Friday so Mr. Jones could go to the dentist. They got back on the logging train and came back in the next day. But after we had been here the first time, I went to the University of Washington Press and said, there is only one book that has ever been written on company towns. And it was published in 1966. And are you interested in another book? And they said, yes, but it can only cover Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, because that is the area that the University of Washington Press is interested in. So I probably spent a year in good, hard research. And then after that, I had the opportunity to interview a lot of people, sort of hit or miss. And then when it came time to get the pictures, other things came up because of the pictures that became available. And there were certain topics that I researched hard. For example, has anyone told you how vehicles got in and out of here? I found this was just fascinating. The company shipped your cars in for free, but they did it on the top of the ore canisters. The barge that ran the ore canisters up and down from Chelan had a somewhat recessed area below the deck. And it's kind of like the places where you put peg toys for Fisher-Price, children's Fisher-Price toys. That's what it was like. And there is a picture in my book, and it was the last picture we were able to get of cars sitting on top of the ore canisters. And that was one of the things that Hal Field did down at Lucerne, was you drove your car on a platform like a pallet, and they winched it on to the platform, onto the ore canisters.
What did you do with the car up here?
Yeah, where would you go?
Oh, I might mention that picture. Somebody had asked me about that just this week, so I had just put a sticky flag on that picture in one of those books up in the museum, if anybody's looking, that shows the car sitting on top of the
orchestra. Is that the same picture?
I don't know if it's the same one you have in your book, because there's two different pictures in that book at the museum, but the little young boy that was up there earlier this week was asking about it, and after he left, I found it. So if anybody's up there in those blue albums over in the corner, there's a sticky note sticking out of the bottom of one of them. I think you'll see a picture of those cars riding on the pallets.
Well, actually, I was given two pictures. They came from... it was at Ansel Snodgrass.
And I think that's where these pictures are from. Maybe the same picture.
The man who was down, Linda knows more about this because she grew up here, but It was Ansel Snodgrass was the Down Lake agent, and this is from his niece by marriage. She found these pictures. I knew they had to exist, and Bill Phillips did some research, and he was over visiting here, and he found this woman in Manson who had these pictures. And I think, well, there is a picture that sort of shows them being winched on, but it wasn't as good a picture, so we went with the other one. So what did you do with the car up here? Well, if you had a car, and a lot of people after the war did have cars, you had to keep it someplace. And some people had them garaged in Chelan, and some people kept them at Lucerne. But I guess, Linda, you kept the car up here because it was yours and you owned it?
Well, and during the summer, you could use it to drive down to the lake to go swimming or fishing or picnicking. And not a lot of families in it. Again, the 50s. I think in the 40s, as you said, there were probably very few up here. But in the 50s, a lot of people would bring them up. And I think part of it was that they did own cars. And some people with brand new cars would actually send them clear out to Chelan for the winter. Mm-hmm. But they would send them out also if they were going on vacation. They'd send them out on the barge so you could take them on a trip.
Right.
Like if you're going to be gone for a couple of weeks on vacation. So that's, you know, you owned a car, so mm-hmm. you kept it here.
And people talked about when they went out to go shopping, like the annual school shopping trip. You probably went in your car, and it was much more convenient to do that than to go out by train because of the difficulty in making connections from Chelan. By the time you got down Lake, then you still had to deal with the train, or it was probably the train in the beginning, and later the bus. So if you had a car, it made it easier. But there were people who lived here and never had cars. I interviewed a woman who lived here in the 30s, and she said she only had ridden a car a few times in her life before she moved out of Holden. And most of those times were in a truck bed, driving from here. Somebody gave her a lift from here to Winston.
Winston.
The miner's
bed.
Yeah,
that's not exactly long.
No. I think she was the same woman who said that she cross-country skied down from Honeymoon Heights, and then the idea was to find an employee who would sneak you back up so you didn't have to hike back up. But apparently that was against the rules.
So. Yeah, I was wondering what you might think from your research of stories. It sounds like men, left to their own devices, have absolutely no interest whatsoever in religion. And I wonder if you think that is a gender issue or something unique to company-owned towns.
I think the men who came and stayed in mining and logging jobs long-term were probably not real social, and I think it's more characteristic of the kind of person who stayed in that job than it is a gender thing. I mean, there were a lot of guys who came here, lived in the bunkhouses for a year or two, went out and married their college sweethearts, and became parts of different communities. And you see the same thing documented when you read the memoirs from logging camps. But there were a lot of guys in the logging camps that was all they knew. They maybe went out twice a year and went on a bender and spent everything that they had saved for the previous 6 months, and then they went back and started all over again. You know, I think that there was a certain group of people who weren't very social and were probably fairly unskilled and maybe were subject to alcoholism, and as long as they were in the camps where it was usually dry, they were okay, and you know, they were like kids getting let out of school. Logging camps typically closed down for 2 weeks, once in July, and these were not the fire mandated shutdowns, but usually over 4th of July and usually at Christmas they shut down, and so for a week each time guys would be turned loose.
They may have been tired too after work. You know, 10-hour days, 6 days a week, or even probably more than that.
Some of it too could have been an age issue. These communities were not; they were more uniform. They were young people,
yes, very young.
Typically. Yeah. You know, working hard long hours. I know I tell people I went to school on a logging scholarship because I worked in logging camps in Alaska going to college, and it was a bunch of young guys, you know, 19 to 25 typically, who at that stage in life, that wasn't a primary interest, going to church, especially for the type of people who seek that type of work.
We have a friend who put himself through college working for the Forest Service and also for Potlatch in Idaho, and he's quoted in the book, and he tells about what it was like to be a college-bound student. And he was really in strong contrast to the guys who marched in and sat down with their steak knives and tucked into their T-bones, and 10 minutes later they were out of there, and you know, on the weekends, this was the 50s, so they had cars. They were out of the community to some place where they could get liquor. So, and even here, there was a card game going 24/7. And there were people who gambled away everything. So they, you know, came with nothing and left with nothing. And so I don't think that was typical of most of the families that came here, because some of the people I interviewed said it was very easy to save money here. Salaries were reasonable, costs were very limited, opportunities to spend money were very limited, and some people have said that this is where they got a grub stake. It was very interesting to me as I started on this project, and I would go different places. Like when I went to the Simpson Company archives in Shelton, the woman who was helping me said, oh, my father and my uncle worked at Holden to work their way through college. And you would run into people who say, oh, I worked at Holden, or I worked at Risdale, and there were all these overlapping people. What you're talking about was very typical. People came someplace for a summer. This town attracted a lot of Ivy League college students because their fathers were executives of the Howe Sound Company, especially after the headquarters was moved to New York. And so they got shipped out here to work for the summers.
So, what years would that be?
What years would that
be? Yeah, what years would that be?
It would have been probably as early as 39 through the early 50s.
So it moved to New York that early?
I don't know when the headquarters was relocated. I didn't pay a lot of attention to that because there had been a lot of parent companies for Howe Sound. It was never headquartered here. The Britannia Beach was where the company really got started. It was originally the Britannia Beach Smelting Company, I think. And then the name was changed to Howe Sound. But that company, they owned the operation in Britannia Beach, which operated, I think, into the 70s. They owned the operation here. They owned an operation at Cobalt, Idaho, which is where a lot of people moved from here. When things were slowing down here, they started transferring managers to Cobalt. And they also owned some operations in Mexico. So, and then, of course, there were lots of mergers that followed.
So when people,
time. I don't have a watch. My watch went to Mount Rainier with one of my children and it never came back.
It's 2 minutes after six.
My signal here didn't stop. So I am doing two more presentations. One is on daily life during the mining days, and I'm going to talk about the basics, like how they got their groceries and where they went to school and things like that. And then I will also talk about some of the ways to research personal or community history if that's something that interests you. So, thank you for coming.
Thank you.